Imagine it is election day. You walk into a voting booth, you mark your ballot, and you feel the quiet satisfaction of having done your democratic duty. For many people, this is where political participation ends. The vote is cast. The decision is made. Democracy has spoken. But what if the most important political decisions were already being shaped long before you arrived at that booth, and will continue to be shaped long after you leave? What if the law that gets passed, the regulation that gets written, or the government contract that gets awarded depends not just on who wins elections, but on a constant, behind-the-scenes struggle for influence that most ordinary citizens never see? This is the world of interest groups and lobbying. It is a world of professional persuaders, enormous sums of money, and carefully crafted information. It is also, depending on who you ask, either a vital part of healthy democracy or one of its greatest threats. Today we are going to walk through this world together, and by the end, you will understand how political power really operates beyond the simple act of voting. Let us start with a story to make this real. Imagine a senator in Washington is handed a new bill. The bill would force car companies to make their vehicles produce less pollution by the year 2030. Within 48 hours, the senator's office is absolutely flooded. Scientists from environmental organizations arrive with thick folders of research showing how air pollution is shortening lives. Representatives from car manufacturing companies arrive with their own economic models, warning that the new rules will cost hundreds of thousands of jobs. A union representing factory workers wants to know what happens to their members. Farmers from the senator's home state are worried about the cost of new trucks. A children's health charity brings photographs of children with breathing problems caused by dirty air. Every single one of these groups wants the senator's attention. Every single one of them wants to shape what happens next. That coordinated effort to reach and influence government decision makers is what we call lobbying. And the organized groups doing the reaching are called interest groups. Let us understand both of these ideas deeply. An interest group is a collection of people or organizations who share a common goal and work together to influence government policy. The word policy here simply means the rules, laws, and decisions that governments make. An interest group might want the government to pass a new law, change an old one, increase funding for something, or stop a proposed regulation from happening. Now, you might immediately ask, is that not what political parties do? It is a fair question, and the distinction matters. A political party, like the Democrats or Republicans in the United States, or Labor and the Conservatives in the United Kingdom, exists mainly to win elections. Its goal is to get its own people into power and then run the government. An interest group has a different and narrower goal. It does not run candidates for office. Instead, it tries to influence whoever is already in office, regardless of which party they belong to. A large pharmaceutical company, for example, wants policies that are good for the drug industry. If a Republican politician seems sympathetic, they will work with that politician. If a Democrat seems equally sympathetic, they will work with that person too. The group's loyalty is to its goal, not to any party. There are many different kinds of interest groups, and it helps to understand the main categories. The largest and often most powerful category is economic interest groups. These exist to protect the financial interests of their members. Think of it this way: if you owned a chain of restaurants, you would want the government to keep the minimum wage low so your labor costs stay manageable. If you were a construction worker, you would want the government to require safe working conditions on building sites. Both of you have an economic interest, and both of you might join a group that fights for that interest.
On the business side, organizations like the United States Chamber of Commerce represent thousands of companies.
They lobby for things like lower taxes, fewer regulations, and free trade deals. On the worker side, labor unions like the AFL-CIO represent millions of employees. They push for higher wages, safer workplaces, and the right of workers to negotiate collectively with their employers. Both of these are economic interest groups, but they often want completely opposite things, which already gives you a sense of why politics can be so contentious. Professional associations are a specific kind of economic group. The American Medical Association represents doctors. The American Bar Association represents lawyers. These organizations lobby on issues related to their profession, such as who is allowed to practice medicine, what medicines can be prescribed, or how lawyers are regulated. They argue they are protecting standards of quality, though critics sometimes point out they are also protecting their members from competition. Then there are public interest groups, which claim to work not for the narrow benefit of their paying members, but for the good of everyone. The Sierra Club fights for environmental protection. Public Citizen advocates for consumer safety. The American Civil Liberties Union, known as the ACLU, defends the civil liberties, meaning the basic rights and freedoms of all Americans, particularly those who are most vulnerable. These groups genuinely believe their work benefits the wider public, not just their supporters. A third important category is single-issue groups. These organizations are laser-focused on one specific cause and often have extremely passionate, motivated supporters. The National Rifle Association, the NRA, exists almost entirely to protect the right of Americans to own guns. Narrow pro-choice America focuses entirely on protecting the legal right to abortion. Mothers Against Drunk Driving, called MAD, was founded by a mother whose daughter was killed by a drunk driver, and it has spent decades pushing for stricter laws on impaired driving. Single-issue groups can be surprisingly powerful because their members care so deeply about that one issue that they vote based on it and donate money based on it. A politician who crosses a single-issue group risks losing a very motivated group of voters. Here is something that might surprise you. Even government bodies are interest groups of a kind. State governments lobby the federal government for money and favorable rules. City governments do the same. The mayor of a city hit by flooding might lobby Congress for disaster relief funds. A state government might lobby to keep a military base from closing because that base brings thousands of jobs and millions of dollars to the local economy. Now that we understand what interest groups are, let us talk about what they actually do. How do they exert influence? The answer involves something called lobbying, and it is more sophisticated than most people realize. The word lobbying comes from a simple historical image. In the 19th century, people who wanted to influence lawmakers would gather in the lobby, which is the entrance hall of the legislature, and try to catch politicians on their way in and out. Today, of course, lobbying is a highly organized, extremely well-funded profession. In the United States alone, it is estimated that over $3 billion is spent on federal lobbying every single year. The people who do it professionally are called lobbyists, and many of them are former politicians or government officials who use their contacts and insider knowledge to help their clients. Scholars who study lobbying divide it into two broad approaches: inside lobbying and outside lobbying. Think of inside lobbying as working within the system through direct private contact with decision makers. Think of outside lobbying as working through public pressure, trying to change what ordinary citizens think and do so that those citizens put pressure on their politicians. Inside lobbying is where professional lobbyists earn their salaries.
The single most important thing a lobbyist does is provide information. This might sound simple, but consider how complicated modern government is.
A senator might have to vote on bills covering agriculture, military spending, healthcare, environmental regulation, technology, immigration, and tax policy all in the same week. No human being can be a deep expert in all of these areas. Lobbyists fill that gap.
They provide research reports, scientific studies, economic analyses, and detailed arguments.
They make the complex simple for the lawmaker. The catch, of course, is that the information is selected to support the lobbyist's side.
A car company's lobbyist will provide data about job losses from environmental regulations, but probably will not highlight the data about healthcare savings from cleaner air. Still, even biased information can be genuinely useful when a senator is trying to understand a complicated technical issue.
Lobbyists also testify at legislative hearings.
When a congressional committee, which is a smaller group of politicians who specialize in an area, is considering a bill, they hold public hearings where experts and interested parties are invited to speak. A lobbyist from an industry group might sit at a long table alongside a public health researcher and a consumer advocate, each presenting their view. This testimony becomes part of the official record. Perhaps most striking is the practice of helping to actually write legislation. Sympathetic lawmakers sometimes give lobbyists a remarkable degree of access, allowing their legal teams to draft the actual language of proposed laws. A senator who wants to help the pharmaceutical industry might ask the industry's lawyers to write a bill's technical provisions, which the senator then introduces in Congress.
Critics find this deeply troubling. Supporters argue that lobbyists often have the most technical knowledge about complex regulatory areas and that using their expertise simply produces better written law. Outside lobbying is different in character.
Here, the goal is not to whisper in a politician's ear, but to make the politician feel pressure from the public at home.
The most straightforward version of this is grassroots lobbying, where the interest group mobilizes its own members to contact their elected officials.
An environmental group might send an email to its 1 million members urging each of them to call their senator. A sudden flood of phone calls from constituents, meaning the people who actually live in that senator's district and vote in that senator's elections, is something politicians pay close attention to.
It signals that the public is watching and cares about the outcome. There is a more troubling version of this tactic called astroturfing.
The name comes from the idea of fake grass.
Genuine grassroots movements grow naturally from ordinary citizens.
AstroTurfing describes a campaign that looks like a spontaneous popular movement, but is actually funded and organized by a corporation or political interest group. A company that wants to stop new environmental regulations might fund a campaign that appears to be local business owners speaking up for jobs, when in reality the whole campaign was designed and paid for in a corporate headquarters.
This kind of deception is deeply controversial and, many argue, deeply undemocratic.
Interest groups also spend large amounts of money on advertising.
You have probably seen television commercials during political seasons that are not paid for by any political party or candidate, but by organizations you may not recognize. These ads try to shape what ordinary people think about an issue.
If enough people come to believe that a certain policy is good or bad, that public opinion becomes a kind of pressure that politicians cannot ignore.
Then there is the most direct and controversial form of influence, money in elections.
Interest groups cannot legally give unlimited amounts directly to a candidate's campaign, but they have found powerful ways around this limitation.
One tool is the Political Action Committee, usually called a PAC.
This is a fundraising arm of an interest group that collects money from its members and donates it directly to candidates who support their goals.
These donations are limited by law, but they are still significant.
An even more powerful tool emerged after a landmark Supreme Court decision in 2010 called Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission.
In this case, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations and unions have the same free speech rights as individuals, and that spending money on political communication is a form of speech.
Therefore, restricting how much a corporation or union can spend on election-related advertisements violates the First Amendment, which is the part of the U.S. Constitution protecting freedom of speech.
This decision created what are called super PACs.
A super PAC can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to run advertisements supporting or opposing a candidate, as long as it does not directly coordinate with that candidate's campaign.
The result has been an enormous explosion in outside money in American elections. In some elections, super PACs backed by a handful of very wealthy donors have spent hundreds of millions of dollars.
To make all of this concrete, let us look at a real example that shows every one of these tools in action. The passage of the Affordable Care Act in the United States in 2010, often called Obamacare, was one of the most fiercely lobbied pieces of legislation in American history.
The bill aimed to extend health insurance to tens of millions of Americans who did not have it. You might expect that the entire healthcare industry would oppose it, since more regulation usually makes businesses nervous. But the reality was far more complicated and fascinating.
The pharmaceutical industry, represented by a lobbying group called PHRMA, actually spent over $100 million in support of the bill.
Why would drug companies support healthcare reform? Because they struck a deal.
They agreed to help pass the bill in exchange for a promise that the government would not use its power to force drug companies to lower their prices.
It was a calculated business decision. More insured Americans would mean more people buying medicine, which meant more revenue for drug companies.
The insurance they were paying for the deal, so to speak, was accepting some new regulations while avoiding the much harsher regulation of drug prices.
Hospitals were also broadly supportive. When people who cannot afford healthcare get sick, they often end up in hospital emergency rooms anyway, and hospitals often cannot collect payment from them. This is called uncompensated care. If those people got health insurance, hospitals would actually get paid. So more insurance coverage meant more money for hospitals, and the American Hospital Association lobbied in favor of the bill.
ARP, which represents older Americans, mobilized millions of its members through classic grassroots lobbying, making phone calls and sending letters to Congress in support of the bill's benefits for elderly people.
On the other side, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, representing the broad business community, spent heavily on advertising campaigns arguing the bill would burden employers with costs they could not afford.
The insurance industry's main lobbying group initially worked with lawmakers to shape the bill, but ultimately turned against the final version when it included rules they opposed, such as the requirement that insurance companies could not deny coverage to people with pre-existing medical conditions, meaning health problems a person already had before getting insurance.
From the insurance company's perspective, having to insure people who were already sick was simply bad for their profits. What you see in the ACA fight is that there is no simple story of business versus the people.
Different economic interests were pulling in different directions.
Some industries supported the reform, others opposed it.
The final law reflected not just the ideals of its supporters, but the deals and compromises negotiated with the most powerful lobbying forces.
You might be wondering whether any of this is legal.
The answer is yes. Almost all of it is legal, and it is protected by the United States Constitution's First Amendment, which guarantees the right to petition the government for a change in policy.
In other words, lobbying is simply an organized form of the most basic democratic right, the right to ask your government for something. However, the United States does regulate lobbying.
The Lobbying Disclosure Act of 1995 requires anyone who is paid to lobby the government to register officially, identify their clients, state which issues they are lobbying on, and report how much they are paid.
This creates a public record that journalists and researchers can examine.
The Honest Leadership and Open Government Act of 2007 tightened these rules further and introduced restrictions on gifts that lobbyists can give to lawmakers. In the past, lobbyists would routinely take politicians to expensive restaurants, give them tickets to sporting events, and organize luxury trips, all as a way of building relationships and goodwill.
The new law made this much harder.
The 2007 law also addressed one of the most troubling practices in Washington, the revolving door.
Imagine a senior official in the Department of Energy, the government agency that regulates oil and gas companies, who retires after 20 years of government service. She knows exactly how the regulations work. She knows every senior official personally. She understands the system from the inside.
If she then immediately goes to work as a lobbyist for an oil company, the oil company is essentially buying her knowledge and her relationships. The government official's years of public service become a commodity that a private interest can purchase.
The revolving door operates in both directions. Former lobbyists also move into government jobs, where they regulate the very industries they used to represent. Neither direction looks good from the perspective of an ordinary citizen.
The 2007 law addressed this by lengthening the cooling-off period, which is the amount of time a former government official must wait before they can legally lobby their former colleagues.
However, critics argue these restrictions are still not nearly strong enough.
We come now to the deepest question: is all of this good or bad for democracy? Here we find a genuine, honest disagreement among serious thinkers, and we should take both sides seriously.
The optimistic view is called pluralism. The word plural simply means many.
Pluralist theory, associated with the political scientist Robert Dahl, argues that interest groups are actually healthy for democracy.
Think about how large and complex a modern country is.
The United States has 330 million people with wildly different lives, jobs, concerns, and values. If a farmer in Iowa has very different needs from a technology worker in California, a retired teacher has different concerns from a small business owner.
Ordinary voting is a blunt instrument. You choose between a small number of candidates every few years, and your single vote covers every issue simultaneously.
Interest groups allow people to organize around their specific concerns and make their voices heard on the issues that matter most to them. In this view, the competition among many different groups is itself a kind of democratic process. No single group can dominate, because other groups will rise up to counter it.
Policy becomes the result of negotiation and balance, which roughly reflects the distribution of interests in society. The pessimistic view is called elitism. This theory argues that the competition is not actually fair or balanced.
The famous political scientist E.E. Schachnader captured the problem in one memorable sentence: "The flaw in the pluralist heaven is that the heavenly chorus sings with a strong upper-class accent." What he meant was that the groups that participate most effectively in the lobbying process are overwhelmingly wealthy, corporate, and business-oriented.
They have more money to hire better lobbyists. They have more money to fund advertising campaigns. They have more money to make campaign contributions.
A coalition of low-income workers trying to raise the minimum wage is technically in the same system as a coalition of large corporations trying to keep it low, but they are not playing the game with the same resources.
The corporations have better lawyers, more lobbyists, and more campaign money.
In the elitist view, this structural advantage means that policy consistently favors the wealthy over everyone else.
There is a third view called hyperpluralism, which offers a different kind of criticism.
The prefix hyper means too much. Hyperpluralism argues that the problem is not that one powerful elite always wins, but that there are now so many powerful, entrenched interest groups that the government cannot make any significant decision at all.
Every group fiercely defends its piece of the pie. Farmers block agricultural reform. Pharmaceutical companies block drug pricing reform. Gun groups block gun control. Financial institutions block banking regulation. The result is paralysis.
Government cannot address big problems because every potential solution is immediately defeated by the groups who would lose from that solution. In this view, the abundance of interest groups has not created a healthy competition that leads to good policy. It has created a political system incapable of change, even when change is desperately needed. Here is where we arrive at the most uncomfortable question of all, and it is worth sitting with it for a moment. If a wealthy technology corporation and a small community environmental group both have the legal right to petition their government, are they truly equal?
The corporation can spend millions on lobbyists, millions on advertising, and millions through super PACs.
The community group can send emails and make phone calls.
Both are legal.
Both are protected by the same constitutional right.
But are they the same?
This question cuts to the heart of what we mean by democracy itself. Democracy, in theory, means that each citizen has an equal voice.
One person, one vote.
But if money amplifies some voices thousands of times louder than others, then the formal equality of the ballot box may not translate into actual equality of influence over what government does.
Does money directly buy politicians?
This is actually a harder question to answer than it seems. Researchers have found it is very difficult to prove that a specific campaign donation changed a specific lawmaker's vote.
What money seems to do is buy access, meaning the ability to have your phone calls returned, to get a meeting, to have your arguments heard. And once you have access and others do not, your arguments are more likely to shape the final outcome.
Money also seems particularly effective not at converting political opponents but at helping friendly politicians stay strong in their positions, and at quietly blocking legislation that never even comes to a vote.
The regulations that exist, the disclosure requirements, and the cooling-off periods represent attempts to make the system more transparent and fair. But most serious observers agree they are insufficient. Shadow lobbying, where influence is exerted through informal channels that fall outside the legal definition of lobbying, remains a significant problem. The full effects of Citizens United and the explosion of super PDAC money are still unfolding and being debated. What we can say with confidence is this: voting matters enormously. Elections determine who holds power.
But between elections, in the daily work of writing and passing and implementing laws, a constant struggle is taking place.
Understanding that struggle, knowing who is involved, what tools they use, and what interests they represent, is essential to being an informed and clear-eyed citizen. Let us bring together the key ideas from today's lesson.
An interest group is an organized collection of people who try to influence government policy without running for office themselves. They differ from political parties because they focus on influencing whoever holds power rather than trying to win power themselves. Interest groups come in many forms: economic groups representing businesses or workers, public interest groups claiming to speak for the wider public, single-issue groups intensely focused on one cause, and even government bodies lobbying other government bodies. Lobbying is the professional practice of communicating with government officials to persuade them.
Inside lobbying involves direct private contact, including providing information, testifying at hearings, and sometimes helping to draft laws. Outside lobbying involves working through the public, using grassroots campaigns, advertising, and campaign finance to create pressure on politicians from the outside.
Super PDACs, created by the Citizens United decision, allow corporations and unions to spend unlimited money on election advertising, dramatically expanding the financial dimension of the system.
The regulation of lobbying attempts to create transparency and limit corruption through disclosure requirements and cooling-off periods. But critics argue these measures do not go far enough. The revolving door, through which officials move between government and lobbying roles, remains a serious concern. Finally, there is a genuine and unresolved debate about what all of this means for democracy. Pluralists see a healthy competition of voices. Elitists see a system tilted toward the wealthy and powerful.
Hyperpluralists see a system so gridlocked by competing interests that it cannot function effectively.
All three views illuminate something real, and wrestling honestly with them is part of what it means to take democracy seriously.